Together, in the light of truth and the warmth of love, we gather to seek, to find, and to share. It is a sacred place, this, a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. A Blessing, a poem by poet laureate, Pulitzer Prize winner, James Wright. Just off the highway to Rochester, Minnesota, twilight bounds softly forth on the grass, and the eyes of those two Indian ponies darken with kindness. They have come gladly out of the willows to welcome my friend and me. We step over the barbed wire into the pasture where they have been grazing all day alone. They ripple tensely. They can hardly contain their happiness that we have come. They bow shyly as wet swans. They love each other. There's no loneliness like theirs. At home once more, they begin munching the young tusks of spring in the darkness. I would like to hold the slenderer one in my arms, for she has walked over to me and nuzzled my left hand. She's black and white. Her mane pulls wild on her forehead, and the light breeze moves me to caress her long ear that is delicate as the skin over a girl's wrist. And suddenly I realize that if I stepped out of my body, I would break into blossom. Wendy Domian received her PhD in cognitive psychology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1977. She joined the faculty at the University of Texas that year and has remained there ever since, understandably, since it's such a wonderful university and Austin is the best city in the world, with the exception of a 5-year timeout to stay home and raise her children. She is currently a senior lecturer in psychology and the assistant director of Plan 2 Honors Program. She has won numerous teaching awards from Plan 2, the Psychology Department, and the College of Liberal Arts. Her most recent interests have centered on the psychology of religion and positive psychology. And she's already improved my life. I know you'll feel the same way. Let us welcome Professor Wendy Domian of the University of Texas.
Good morning. It's a real pleasure to be back here again and share your lovely service. It's not given to many 5-year-olds to be able to change the course of an entire discipline, but it was given to Nikki. One day, Nikki and her dad were outside in the garden, and her father was working, and she was playing around as kids do, asking questions and trying to get his attention, and he wasn't being very patient with her. And so finally, she stopped and she looked at him and she said, "Daddy, do you remember last year when I was just a little baby?" And he said, "Well, yes, Nikki, I do." Said, "And do you remember how I was able all by myself to stop having temper tantrums?" He said, "Oh, yes, and your mom and I were very proud of you." She said, "Well, I think if a little baby like I was last year could stop having temper tantrums, then a big grown-up daddy like you should stop being all the time so grumpy." This had a big effect on him. And because her father was Martin Seligman, who at the time was the president of the American Psychological Association, it had a big effect on psychology. Because he sat there and he started thinking to himself, "My life is great. I'm happily married. I have wonderful kids. I have work that I love. Why is it that I'm grumpy? Why is it that I spend so much of my time thinking about the things that haven't worked out or that have disappointed me or that I don't like, and so little time on all these things that are just so good?" So he thought about it for a while, and he made phone calls, utilizing all the power of his office and his prestige, to some of the most famous and kind of creative psychologists around, and said, "You may think you're going on vacation over winter break, but you're not. You're coming to a conference. We're going to rewrite psychology." And they got together, and they decided to think about what there was about people that was good. Now, this may seem like something you would think that people had done, but psychology as a discipline doesn't. It focuses on what's bad. It focuses on trauma and pain and illness, on aggression, on all the parts about people that are problematic. Now, this makes a lot of sense. What we want to do is help people. So we want to help them to go in and deal with these things and do better with them and feel better. And that's hugely beneficial. But most of us, most of the time, fortunately, aren't struggling with trauma and crisis and disability. We just want our lives to be better and more fulfilling. And psychology has had very little to say about that. Now, this is unfortunate because it gives rise to a point of view in which life is mostly about the absence of pain. Freud, for example, once famously said that the goal of psychoanalysis is to take sheer human misery and transform it into ordinary human unhappiness. Now, that's a goal, and it's a worthwhile goal, but as a philosophy of life, it's a little bit limited. Now, there are pretty good reasons for doing this kind of thing. It turns out that human beings are set up to be more attuned to and focus on the negative qualities of their lives. We have far more negative emotions than we do positive emotions, by a ratio of 3 to 4 to 1. Those emotions are much more distinct for us. So it's very easy. I'm sure any one of you could give me a concise and pithy definition of fear or anger, and all your definitions would be quite a lot alike. Happiness, joy, contentment, that is much, much harder. I teach a freshman seminar fairly frequently on these kinds of topics, and we always start by trying to define something like happiness. And you say, okay, folks, what's happiness? And they go, oh, that's easy. And there's this dead silence. And by the end of a period, we usually have 155 definitions because it's not as clear. Negative emotions have very specific physiological patterns that go with them. So, for example, one of the critical cues to fear is that your body temperature drops. You get very cold. You know, it's not an accident that Gothic horror novels always start out, it was a dark, cold, stormy night. They want to evade this. You've never read one, I would bet, that says, there was a beautiful tropical storm rolling in over the ocean. It doesn't do it for you. By the same token, when it's hot out, things get very bad. People get angrier, they fight, they're quicker to anger. Any police department will tell you that they don't like the summer. And one reason for this is that heat is a cue internally to anger. When we get angry, our body temperature rises up. So when we're hot from the outside, we're much more inclined to focus on these little cues to anger. Negative emotions also compel action. When you're afraid, you run away. When you're angry, you hit back. When you're disappointed, you look for compensation. Now think about the positive ones. What do you really do when you're happy? You know, you probably just sit there and kind of grin, like, you know, doesn't do much. So my evolutionary colleagues are fond of saying that we need negative emotions. They're the emotions that enable us to escape from danger, to fight back against aggression, to know when our lives are at risk. We have to have them. Positive emotions are just sort of an epiphenomena. They're just there. And this was the kind of issue that the folks who started thinking about the positive parts of human nature were concerned about. Was there a reason why we feel things like joy and contentment? Or is it just something that kind of accidentally happens in life? And the real good stuff, the important stuff, is dealing with the problems. When they began looking at it, it turned out that there were a lot of things that feeling good do for us. So I'll give you two kind of eclectic pieces of data to start with. One study, they looked at a convent of nuns that had been there for well over 100 years. And they looked at letters that the nuns write when they're transitioning from kind of their temporary phase to their permanent phase, assessing their life and talking about their projected future. And they used a system to rate these letters on how much positive content there was. I'm thrilled to be entering my life as a nun because of the joy of unison with God. Versus negative things. I'm entering my life with God hoping to relieve myself of spiritual pain. They found that the overall rating, when you looked at the kind of most, say 25% most positive and 25% most negative, was astonishing in terms of what had happened to these people in their lives. By the time the group, a cohort, was 80, over 80%, 85% actually, of the women who were very positive were still alive. Only 32% of the ones who were quite negative were. When you go up to 94, 56% of the sort of joyful optimists were still living. Only 11% of the pessimistic folks were. Big impact. A similar study was done, more controlled study, in Boston. They looked at men who had graduated from Harvard around 1940, about a five-year period in there, and they looked at a comparable number of men from inner city Boston of the same age. And they followed them throughout their lives, having assessed them at the outset on positive traits like optimism, humor, altruism, ability to postpone gratitude, things like that. And they found that these qualities, which the author termed mature defenses in life, predicted outcomes tremendously. It predicted the quality of their relationships, it predicted their success in whatever domain they were living, and it predicted their health. For two groups as disparate in their opportunities and the nature of their lives as the very privileged graduates of Harvard and the very lacking in privilege men living in an inner city. These positive attributes mattered. To give you a very specific study that I always find amazing that it has this impact, one of the things that indicates true joy and happiness is what's called a genuine smile. You know, this kind of smile that kind of radiates up out of people and they just grin from ear to ear. You know, if you think about something that makes you really happy, you'll just break into that kind of smile, as opposed to the kind of forced social smiles we all make. They looked at high school yearbooks from many high schools, and they ranked women in terms of the genuine smile. They pulled out the ones who really had it. And then they looked at the others. And the yearbooks they were looking at were older, like 40 or 50 years older. And then they looked at what had happened to these women in their lives. Remarkably enough, and this has been repeated several times, this kind of study, the women with that joyful smile married more frequently, their marriages lasted more, they were happier, their children liked their parents better, their children were more successful in life, they were more satisfied with whatever career they picked, and this was long ago enough that a lot of them picked staying home and raising their kids as a career, they were just happier. Well, that's amazing. Now, don't go home and kind of stand in front of the mirror and practice smiling. You know, it's not like that. It's that this smile was a welling up of genuine joy from people. Study after study after study found that people who are happy and optimistic and have all these positive qualities are more successful. Their relationships are better. They have better friendships. They're physically healthier. By orders of magnitude, they're mentally healthier. It goes on and on and on. It's absolutely amazing. Well, you might start to think, well, why? You know, if negative emotions protect us, then what is it about positive emotions that could possibly make people have happy lives? Your first thought might be, well, if all these good things are happening to these people, of course they feel good. You've just got the chicken and the egg backwards. Well, in fact, not really, because in work that we'll get to a little bit later, when you teach people to be happier, when you teach them to think about a world in a way that's more optimistic, more joyful, their lives improve. Just changing the frame makes a huge difference. So what could it be? What do you get from being positive that does something useful? Well, it turns out that it gives you a whole different cognitive set on the world. When you're experiencing something negative, fear, anger, disappointment, pessimism, your view of the world gets very narrow, and it gets very, very action-oriented. People focus on a very few number of alternatives. They reach a conclusion about what alternative they believe in, and they try to take action immediately. They're very resistant to outside information, very resistant to creative thinking, very resistant to reframing the world. Now, you can think about America post 9/11, when as a country we were all doing that, narrow, action-oriented, resistant to other information. On the other hand, when people are feeling good, when they're experiencing contentment and satisfaction and happiness and joy, their whole cognitive frame expands. They become creative, they engage in outside-the-box thinking, They think with greater intuition. They think more clearly. And you can show this over and over and over again in studies, starting with little kids all the way up. The basic design of such a study is to promote happiness in somebody and make them feel good. And you can do it in a wide variety of ways. You can show really uplifting movies, or you can have them solve a set of ambiguous problems and tell them that they did brilliantly regardless of how they did. You can have somebody, a very attractive member of the opposite sex, come in and flirt with them. Or you can actually just give people a really good piece of chocolate, which does promote genuine, real happiness. No, it truly does. And then you have them do some kind of problem. And whether it's, you know, three-year-olds naming their colors, or five-year-olds finding hidden figures, or radiologists being asked to read very difficult slides, the ones who've been made to feel really good do better, over and over and over. You know, I demonstrate this for myself every year in my humongously big intro psych class. I pick one of the four exams randomly, and I come to that exam and I give everybody chocolate. I just tell them I'm being nice to them. Always highest average, significantly higher. My son, who's a junior now at UT, was so impressed by this that he started bringing a bag of chocolate to all his exams for him and the people he likes. But not too many, so you don't ruin the curve, you know. But it's really a powerful phenomenon. And the chocolate's a good thing. It actually releases, you know, chemicals in the brain that yield up good and positive emotions, especially in women. Remarkably enough, this women and chocolate thing, it's very, very real. Okay, back to the topic. So it enables you to think clearly and creatively and positively, which is going to have an affirmative impact on your life. One of the things that we've found tremendously in trying to get people to live differently or to improve illness states is that it comes primarily from getting them to do differently. It's not so hard to get people to understand their problems. Where the real problem comes is getting them to take action on it. And this has been true all the way back from Freudian psychology, when he would become tremendously confused about the fact that his patients now had this complete understanding of the issue and changed nothing in what they did. To give you an example of this, some of the earliest work in how to deal with this therapeutically came from Aaron Beck, who was an analytically trained psychologist, and found that psychoanalysis with people who were depressed didn't seem to help. The more his patients talked in analysis, the worse they seemed to get. And then when he tried doing groups, and in group therapy you get people with common problems together to talk and they get insight from each other, and it works really well, except with folks who are depressed, who make each other work. So you'd have kind of Maggie saying, oh, group, gosh, I've had a bad week, I'm so depressed about A. And then Jeremy would say, oh, yeah, A happened to me too, but I also had B. And then Seymour would say, oh, I've got A and B, but also C and D. And they'd make it worse and worse and worse, because they were thinking about the world with this depressive etiology. What helps is to change the way they look at the world. The single most effective treatment for depression, more so than antidepressants, is cognitive therapy to reframe how you see things. You know, people who are depressed characteristically engage in an attributional style, attributions being ways you explain the world to yourself, that has three characteristics. It's very, very internal. Everything is their fault. It's very negative. Everything is bad, absolutely everything, and it's permanent. It's never going to get better. Now, that sounds extreme, but it's not, particularly in the topic the person's depressed about. It turns out if you make them focus, you teach them to think externally, part of this is my fault, but part of it's somebody else's fault. Yes, things are bad, but life can change and I can change them. Things get remarkably better because people get very fixated on the way they look at the world. And the worse they feel, the greater that fixation becomes. And it can even be in relatively minor things to leave major depression. My favorite example is a student I had in a freshman seminar who would come in all the time and tell me how she had no friends because nobody liked her. She just wasn't a likable person. No one would ever like her. She'd never have friends. And it was all her fault for being such an uninteresting, socially unenlightened person. Well, she convinced herself of this to such a degree that she never talked to anybody. She would come into the seminar every day. She'd sit down, she'd open the newspaper, and she'd read. And I know how intense this was because one of the guys in this class had a horrible crush on her. He'd come and sit next to her every day, and he'd look at her and look at her, and he'd try to talk to her, and she'd do nothing. So after a while, I kind of got fed up with this conversation I was having, and I said, look, you were setting this up. Nobody likes me. So, well, what about Joe, who sits next to you? He's got a horrible crush on you. No, he doesn't. So, yeah, he does. Really, he does. Big argument ensues. I finally said, okay, prove it to me. Tomorrow, I want you to go in and sit down, look at Joe, and smile at him and say hi. That's all you have to do. That's all I have to do, and then you'll believe me? Absolutely. So she goes in, she sits down, looks at him. Hi. He was all over her. He's, you know, they've been dating for 3 years now. But the point was that she just wouldn't open her mind to the fact that she might be wrong because she was so concentrated on her misery and her presumption that this was all her fault and she was terrible. Now, I became interested in this myself because of my interest in psychology of religion. A finding that I'd always found remarkable in a lot of ways is that people who practice a religion, regardless of what the religion is, within kind of the normative frame, no Satanism and things like that, and with a minor caveat for strong sin and damnation religions, but most religions, regardless of what they are, if people practice them, they have all the same benefits you see for positive emotions. They're happier, they're healthier, et cetera, all of that. And you don't see this in comparison studies of secular organizations that try to provide the same thing for their members. So, you know, if you belong to a church and you work in the church services and you go to the social events and you work on the committees, you will benefit from that membership in a way that you don't if you, say, are a passionate member of a country club and spend the same amount of time and have the same amount of social support. And this never made a whole lot of sense to me as a psychologist. I couldn't see why one should necessarily be so much better than the other. And then when this positive psychology literature started emerging, I began to wonder if this could be because churches promote behaviors that lead to positive states. So I started looking a little bit at what happens when people actively try to do the things that religions tell you to do. Be grateful, be thankful, be forgiving, be loving, do things for other people, focus on the inner things in yourself and not the external. And it turns out that when people assertively do any of those things, much less all of them, in a very deliberative way, their lives get better in all the same ways we've been talking about. Now, these are not things that most of us do naturally. For all the good evolutionary reasons that negative emotions are so compelling, we tend to focus on what's wrong. We tend to focus on what hurts. We tend to focus on what's threatening. And we go through life without thinking, most of the time, very consciously about all the things that are enriching and gratifying and good. But religion asks you to do that. You know, when you come here and you listen to your hymns or you look at the readings, they tell you to think about these things, about what there is in life that you should focus on that's good. It turns out that as hard as this is for us, and it is hard, it's hard for people to be grateful. It's hard for people to be forgiving. Think about it in yourself. It's not a natural impulse. To forgive someone, for example, means that they have injured you. And instead of keeping up a barrier of defensiveness and saying, you hurt me, I'm going to keep my distance from you, you sit back and you say, yeah, you hurt me, but I understand that and I'm going to forgive you. People can hold grudges about the most astonishing things. One time we were talking about this in my seminar, one of my lifetime favorite students, who is this effervescent, bubbly, you know, little girl kind of, said, I remember that, I remember it. Susie Daniels in middle school, she knew a secret and she told it and she was so passionate. And this is what, you know, she's in college, this very successful girl, thinking back on seventh grade and this injury she'd been nurturing in her head by rehearsing it over and over and over again that was done to her. It's hard to sit up and say, well, I can forgive that. And not just in your head, but in your life and your emotions to let it go. But when you do, it feels incredibly good. And if you're serious about the things you practice, you do that. Not all the time, but some of the time. I've tried this with some of my students, giving them exercises that require them to focus on these things. And I'm always amazed at how reliably it works. So one of the ones we do that they never, ever believe in is this. I'll tell them this week, I want you to pick something to do that you will really enjoy. Something very self-indulgent, just for your benefit, something you really wanted to do, and do it. Really think about how it feels. Write about it afterwards. Really enjoy it. Later in the week, I want you to pick something to do that will really benefit someone else that you don't want to do. It's cheating to pick something that will help someone but you like doing it, something you really dislike. And I want you to do it, and I want you to think about how you feel during it and afterwards. And now college students as a group are more self-involved than most of the population. You know, it's all about me those years. So they sit there and say, oh, this is silly. I know how that's going to come out. I'm going to have a lot more fun doing this than doing that. Almost always, they come back in and they're really amazed at the fact that they didn't feel all that happy doing this really self-indulgent thing when they compared it to how good it felt doing something really valuable for someone else that they didn't want to do. And it really is, for a lot of them, a very life-changing kind of thing to realize. Another one that's very powerful, I know that when I tried this, I try all these myself before I do them with the kids, really had an impact on me, is to think of someone that you should be truly grateful to. Someone who did something for you that changed your life, that was really transformational, that you would be a different person now without them. And at first, just kind of, I say, well, my mom and dad were pretty good, you know, but you say, no, really, think about somebody who really made a difference, really did. And almost everybody, when you really think about it, has at least one person, usually a couple like that in your lives, often someone that you interacted with when you were younger. You didn't think much about it at the time. And now as an adult, you can say, wow, they really made a difference. Write them a letter or go and see them and tell them. And it's a remarkable thing. And I think the reason it's so powerful is the process of doing that makes you sit back and realize that there are all kinds of people out there who've really done things for you, and that most of the time we don't think about that. We don't think about the person who helped us, we think about the person who didn't. You know, you see this all the time. I do as a teacher. Outside of the groupies that every teacher has who kind of follows them around, most of the time you hear from the kids who are unhappy. Because if it's good, if things are going well, they don't pay much attention to it. But if they're angry at you, you're going to hear about it. So, and that's not good. You know, one of the findings in psychology that I think everybody should know about is we're all taught that it's a good thing to vent your anger, you know, get it out. Turns out when you vent your anger, all that happens is you get angrier. It's about the worst thing you can do. I mean, you need to put an issue on the table, you need to put it out there and talk about it, but yelling and screaming and emoting always makes it worse. And it makes it worse because anything that makes these negative emotions stronger makes your life harder. This is the virtue part. You know, I've come to think over the years that our society has lost a lot by not stressing traditional virtues, not because of their moral content, but because of their psychological impact. That it's good to be courageous. It's good to be other-directed. It's good to be thankful. It's good to be grateful. It's good to have these qualities that are not primarily about you and your magnificence and wonderfulness, but about other things. And it has an impact. It makes people stronger and better. We see this in therapy, too. Now, the kind of underlying idea of therapy has always been that you go in and you excise this negative thing, you fix it, you cure it, people will no longer feel bad, and then they'll feel good. And that's intuitive. Most of us feel like our negative to positive emotions lie in a continuum, so sad to happy. As you get less sad, you get more happy. In fact, it's not like that. Negative emotions and positive emotions are independent. You really can love and hate someone simultaneously, be happy and sad simultaneously. And it turns out that if you fix a problem, you take away something, you make somebody not feel negatively about something, they don't feel good, they just feel kind of neutral. It takes work and effort to build in that positive side of the continuum. It's something you have to deliberatively focus on. Now, for some people, it's easier than others. You know, one of the things that people tend to find kind of distressing is the fact that personality traits are largely heritable. You know, the day sort of the sperm joins the egg and things start, it's set in stone how likely that baby is to be happy. There's a range of happiness from people who are born, so no matter what happens to them, they're going to feel pretty good, to people who no matter what happens to them, they're not going to feel so good. Now, between this range, life moves you around. So, for example, shyness is highly genetically coded. You can tell from the very first months in a child's life if they're going to be very shy. So in the range of kind of the shyness continuum, that child is up here. No matter what happens, that child's going to be shy. But their life will move them within that range. So the parents who either overprotect the shy, oh, you know you're shy, you don't want to go do that, or don't accept it and push them out there and scare them, are going to produce a kid at the highest level of shyness. The parents who get it right, who encourage them to go out there but don't push them, who make them feel more confident, will get a child who's the least shy that child can be for their genetic inheritance. And that's most things. But what that means is you need to work with your own emotions. You need to work with the conditions of your own life to live it to the fullest. So one of my favorite stories about this comes from a therapist who was seeing a client, and the guy came to see him because the women in his life kept leaving him. And they kept leaving him because they kept saying, you're not emotional enough, you're not romantic enough, you're empathetic enough. And so the therapist tried to work with him to find his problems and make him more emotional. And at the end of years of this, he said, look, I think you just like this. I think there's nothing wrong with you. You just have a very narrow range of emotions. And the client was devastated. He said, well, that means no one will ever love me. He said, no, I figured this out, the therapist did. You work for an internationally based company. You get them to transfer you to London. All those Brits, they work to have narrow emotional ranges. You'll be a great hit. He did it. And I can say that's true. My older son and his wife live in Britain, and they really do are very enclosed people. Within a year, the guy was married. It worked great by changing his environment and his way of thinking about himself. Not that he was defective, but that he had a limitation that he needed to move into another environment. This kind of reframing is hugely helpful in almost everything. So, for example, it enabled me to finally have a good answer to the most common problem I hear about, particularly from freshmen, who come in and say, I don't have any friends. It's such a big university. I can't meet anybody. You know, I'm shy. I don't have any social skills. I get embarrassed. I know that the person I'm talking to isn't interested in me. And what I tell them now all the time is when you talk to someone, don't focus on how scared you are or shy you are or how bad you feel. Take yourself out of it. Focus on the other person. Be aware that that person may be shy and scared and insecure and try your best to make them feel good. It works like a charm. It's quite remarkable because it takes you out of yourself and into somebody else. So I think there's this huge message here about attempting to live our lives well, attempting consciously, because we won't do it naturally, most of us. When we think about this is wrong, this is bad, this is disappointing, to pull ourselves back and say, well, yeah, but what's good? What's positive? Particularly in the world today with the recession and a lot of our lives changing, it's very easy to lose track of what we have in terms of the things that we're focusing on that maybe we don't anymore. And there's a wonderful concept that you can use in this. And it's called flow. A Hungarian psychologist, whose name I absolutely can't pronounce, developed this notion. And he talks about it in terms of looking for the activities that are right for you, things where you have flow, where when you do them, time just goes by and you're totally engaged and you're totally absorbed. And that's the peak of human experience. When you're doing that, people are at their best. And these are active, engaged things. One of the things my students always hate is when I tell them that something that induces negative emotion every time guaranteed is watching television. If you want to feel better about the world, don't watch television. It's a very simple thing. But if you can get into a flow, you're good. Now, if you're lucky, your life produces those activities for you all the time. But in the framework I'm giving you now, you can work to produce them in activities you have to do. This is another exercise we do that takes practice, but it works. Taking something you don't naturally find to be an enriching experience And instead of saying, oh, when is this going to be over? Why do I have to do this? You know, in a better world, I wouldn't, da-da-da-da-da. Try and make it rewarding. Try and find something about it that's really valuable. You know, my least favorite activity in life is faculty meetings. If I were to win the lottery, I would leave everything else about my job the same, but I would never go to another meeting till the day I die. And I would always sit there, and I would make it worse. I think, God, these people are jerks, and they're so unreasonable, and why do I have such a waste of time, and da-da-da-da, and I keep really kind of winding myself up. And for my own flow activity when we did this, I decided I was going to find something valuable about these meetings that would give me flow. And for me, what it was is I tried hard to come to an understanding, as near as I could as a psychologist, of what the people were doing and why they were doing it, and see if I could use this to figure out the dynamics and get it to come out the way I wanted it to. Well, I don't always get it to come out the way I wanted it to, but it became an enriching, challenging experience because now I was trying to get something out of it as opposed to resisting it. And I'm talking too long, so let me finish. But what I'd like to suggest to y'all is that I think, particularly in the context of this church, which is, from what I can tell in my 2 weeks here and what I've read, remarkably oriented towards finding the best in people, try to find the best in your own lives. Try to reprogram yourself, so to speak, so that when you go to what's negative, you stop yourself and say what's positive. When you go to what's difficult, you stop and say what's good. I had a morning this morning when everything went wrong. I didn't even think I was going to get here. And I started thinking, ah, this and this and this and this. And I stopped myself and I said, okay, stop. You're about to have become the grandmother of two separate grandchildren. How could a world be bad in which that's going to happen? And it really changed my whole outlook on life by making me think about something big as opposed to the broken computer and da-da-da-da-da-da-da and all the daily minutiae. So I would suggest to try that. Try assertively to live the best of your life. And I'd like to leave you with an invocation from the yogic tradition that I always find very meaningful. The highest and the best in me reaches out to honor the high and the best in you. Namaste. Thank you for having me.
We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of liberty. These we carry in our hearts.